From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nobel and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Saul Bellow about becoming one of the first post-war Jewish American writers to enter the literary establishment. Also today, NFL referee Jerry Markbright gives us his view from behind the scrimmage line and tells us about his first and only ambiguous call. An Egyptian-born poet, Gregory Janikian, conjures up his childhood memories of coming to America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The White House said today it's warned this weekend that there might be a coup attempt in Panama, but officials say they did not become involved with the insurgents' plan. Those details and more came out during a White House briefing a day after the unsuccessful coup. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the advance word came not from the rebels involved in yesterday's aborted coup, but from unnamed third parties. Fitzwater characterized the advance word as rumblings and said the administration did nothing to encourage the insurgents. The spokesman defended the Bush administration's lack of participation in yesterday's activities, saying the White House did not want to become involved militarily in Panama's internal affairs. Fitzwater said, however, that U.S. troops were mobilized to block roads and bridges leading to U.S. bases in Panama in an effort to protect U.S. citizens. And he said American contact was made with what he called low-level insurgents during yesterday's activities, who claimed they had General Manuel Noriega in captivity and planned to keep him their prisoner rather than turn him over to the U.S. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The number of East German refugees seeking passage through Poland has been rising since Czechoslovakia's decision to close its East German border. About 400 new emigres have registered this week at the West German Embassy in Warsaw. Jane Dabia reports from Warsaw.
The Polish Red Cross is transporting the emigres by bus to modest resorts just outside Warsaw. Most of the refugees cross the Polish border legally. East German citizens may enter Poland without a visa, but they require exit papers from their own government. However, one young man who chose not to wait for such papers said he swam across the Odra River into Polish territory. He reported that he fled from Polish soldiers who took one of his companions captive. The Minister of Foreign Affairs, Krzysztof Skubiszewski, earlier promised that refugees would not be sent back to East Germany. However, today, a spokesman for the Ministry of the Interior said those who try to enter Poland illegally will not be allowed in. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Israeli troops killed two masked Palestinian youths and wounded at least 21 others in fights in the occupied territories today. An army spokesman said the two were killed when they ignored warning shots along with an order to stop. Residents said the shooting started mass demonstrations in one refugee camp. Also today, three residents of the occupied territories were killed by other Palestinians. NASA today confirmed October 12th as the launch date for the space shuttle Atlantis. The shuttle is scheduled to launch a nuclear-powered space probe for man's closest look ever at Jupiter. However, officials of the space agency will be watching more than the weather in preparation for the launch. A coalition of anti-nuclear groups has asked a federal court in Washington, D.C. to postpone the flight until the risks associated with launching the Jupiter Explorer Galileo are made clear. The coalition claims that NASA has underestimated the potential for cancer deaths in the event of a shuttle accident. It's NPR. The jury that convicted Richard Ramirez of the 13 so-called Night Stalker murders in Southern California recommended the death penalty today. As he was escorted out of the courtroom, Ramirez said, quote, "Big deal. Death always went with the territory. I'll see you at Disneyland." The judge will make the final decision when he sentences Ramirez in November. The federal government is taking four major cities, Detroit, El Paso, San Antonio, and Phoenix, to court, charging that they've let heavy industries get away with illegally dumping toxic wastes through municipal sewer systems. As Michael Richards reports, it's the first time the EPA has taken such widespread action to stop the dumping of toxics into those sewer systems.
Local governments are supposed to regulate industrial discharges and fine companies that dump toxics into sewer systems with their wastewater. But the problem, according to EPA Administrator William Riley, is that local governments have often looked the other way because the polluters are often important to the local economy.
These are major industries, large employers, contributors to the tax base. But absent Absent effective enforcement by the municipalities, the program won't work, the treatment plants won't work, and the water won't get any cleaner.
Riley says this federal action sends a message not only to the four cities named today, but to other cities as well that they'd better police industrial sewage more closely. But some environmentalists are concerned that the penalties involved may not be big enough to induce enough local authorities to improve their performance. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards in Washington.
Scientists in Canada say they discovered the oldest rock in the world, dating back nearly 4 billion years. A team of U.S. and Australian geologists found the ancient stones in a remote region of Canada's Northwest Territory. And Secretariat, one of the greatest horses in the history of thoroughbred racing, was put to death today because of an incurable hoof condition. The 19-year-old horse died at Claiborne Farm in Paris, Kentucky, where he had stood at stud since his retirement in 1974. In 1973, Secretariat won horse racing's Triple Crown, the first to do so since Citation in 1948. This is NPR in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Saul Bellow, is perhaps the United States' most honored living writer, having received the Nobel, the Pulitzer, and three National Book Awards. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani has described Bellow as creating characters who are caught in the middle of a spiritual crisis, overwhelmed by the sheer muchness of the world, and frightened by the stubborn fact of death. Bellow was born in Montreal in 1915, but grew up in Chicago, where he lives today and where many of his novels are set. His books include The Adventures of Augie March, Seize the Day, Herzog, Humboldt's Gift, and Henderson the Rain King. His new book is a novella called The Bella Rosa Connection. The narrator of the story heads an institute for memory technique in Philadelphia. He tells the story of his late friend, a Jewish immigrant who was saved from the Holocaust in an escape operation overseen by the Broadway producer Billy Rose. I asked Saul Bellow to read the opening of The Bella Rosa Connection.
As founder of the Mnemosyne Institute in Philadelphia, 40 years in the trade, I trained many executives, politicians, and members of the defense establishment. And now that I am retired, with the institute in the capable hands of my son, I would like to forget about remembering, which is an Alice in Wonderland proposition. In your twilight years, having hung up your gloves or sheathed your knife, you don't want to keep doing what you did throughout your life. A change, your kingdom for a change. A lawyer will walk away from his clients, a doctor from his patients. A general will paint China, a diplomatist turn to fly fishing. My case is different in that I owe my worldly success to the innate gift of memory. A tricky word, innate, referring to the hidden sources of everything that really matters. As I used to say to clients, memory is life. That was a neat way to impress a member of the National Security Council whom I was coaching. But it puts me now in an uncomfortable position because if you have worked in memory, which is life itself, there is no retirement except in death.
So Bellow, as this character tells us in the first paragraph, he wants to forget about remembering. Has this been a period where memory has been especially persistent or troubling to you?
Well, I seem to be one of these curious cases of a person whose memory is continuous. Nietzsche wrote an essay on history in which he says some rather curious things about remembering. He says a strong man can forget those things that will injure him. And I suppose that that's true, so that the power of forgetting should be paired with the power of memory, because the capacity to forget is will preserve your life in some instances. On the other hand, there is no continuity in human life. Without memory, it's one of the things that distinguishes us from the animals. Not all of us want to be distinguished, but if you insist on distinguishing, making such a distinction, this is one of the main points to bear in mind.
I want to quote something that you wrote in 1987. This was in an essay in the New York Times Book Review. And you wrote, as a Middle Westerner, the son of immigrant parents, I recognized at an early age that I was called upon to decide for myself to what extent my Jewish origins, my surroundings, my schooling were to be allowed to determine the course of my life. When you were young and realizing that you had these choices to make, what did you see as your options when you were thinking how much your background was going to determine what your future was going to be?
Well, I think that at a very early age, I think before puberty, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and this really, in a way, drew me apart from my family.
Your father had been a businessman.
Well, my father had been the usual rabbinical student who came to America and found nothing better to do than business, and he didn't do it too well. He was not rigidly orthodox. I was not imposed on that way. I just wanted to go my own way, and I did.
You also said that you think you might have become a rabbi if the great world, the world of the streets, had not been so seductive. What was seductive? What did you see? And what do you mean by the world of the streets? What exactly were you exposed to?
I mean Chicago in the 20s. I mean the streets, street life, pool rooms, sports, a modicum of criminal activity, which was inescapable in Chicago during the 20s, the bang-bang time of Prohibition and so on. Just the sense that you were participating in the life of this immense and expanding civilization, which was so fascinating that it drew me away from my Jewishness, not so as to make me forget it, but that I wanted to combine it with other things. I mean, I was deeply unwilling to follow anybody's blueprint from either side of the equation.
I've got to ask, you mentioned something about criminal activity. Were you involved in petty crimes yourself?
Well, every kid is involved in petty crimes, always a certain amount of theft and shoplifting and criminal intentions, which are much more powerful than the crimes you commit when you're a kid.
Were you ever caught for anything?
No, I wasn't, no. I was never interested in shoplifting at Woolworths and things like that that people used to get caught at. But if I were working in a department store, as I once did, say at a barrel of surprise packages for Christmas, for a quarter apiece, my buddy and I, who were dressed as Santa Claus's helpers, would pocket an occasional quarter. Never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went in for big-time dishonesty.
Right. So when you were growing up, did you read a lot, too?
Yes, I did.
Did that let you in on other worlds outside Chicago?
Oh, immensely. That was really terrific. Of course, the first book I read was... the first books I read were the opening books of the Old Testament, which I read in Hebrew and translated into Yiddish, which made an enduring impression on me.
Pretty ambitious for starting out, huh?
Well, I think this is the way Jewish kids started out in traditional Orthodox families.
Did your mother want you to be a rabbi?
Oh, definitely. Like my grandfather, her father.
And what were your parents' reaction when they figured out that what you wanted to do was right?
Well, my father thought it was a brainstorm. My mother died when I was only 17, so she didn't live to see the worst. But my father was dismayed at all this and thought it was improvident and so on and so on. I thought he was improvident, watching him run his business.
What kind of business was it?
He was had a coal yard and supplied apartment houses with coal.
Did that seem very boring to you, like the last life of the world you'd want to have?
No, it was very. It was not boring at all. It was very exciting. And I often worked in the yard. Not shoveling coal, but at the scale. So I knew the life at an early age.
Saul Bellow is my guest. He has a new novella. It's called The Bella Rosa Connection. Now, you went to New York for the first time, I think, when you were 17. You went to sell your first novel. I'm thinking of how much confidence you must have had in yourself to, at the age of 17, think that you had a chance of selling it to a publisher.
Your information is a little incorrect.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
How old were you?
It wasn't I that went to New York at 17. It was my pal, Sidney Harris.
Oh, I thought you went with him.
No, no, no. I didn't go with him.
Oh.
No, I had to stay at home and face the music.
Which was what?
Which was that I had conspired with him to run away to New York. He had written a novel. We were both schoolboys, high school boys. I wrote the introduction to the novel, which was nearly as long, I think. Then we tossed a coin to see who would take it to New York to be published. This was on Division Street in Chicago in the old Polish-Jewish neighborhood. He won the toss. So without a moment's hesitation, he tucked the manuscript under his sweater and he took off. I had to answer to his mother.
What'd you tell her?
He was an only child. I wouldn't tell her anything, of course, because that would be squealing. Though I was a literary type, I was also brought up in Chicago, and I knew how bad it was to squeal. So I kept my mouth shut. And his mother, who was an English woman, Cockney lady, and my eldest brother, who was in the habit of policing me, took me down to the Missing Persons Bureau. We went downtown on the streetcar. And I was confronted by the cops in the Missing Persons Bureau. Where is Sidney J. Harris? I wouldn't talk. That was bad. But my brother, when he got home, broke into the only private lock drawer I'd ever had in boyhood. And he found letters that Sidney had been sending me. And so the game was up. But it wasn't I that went to New York at the age of 17. It was Sidney.
So what was the outcome of the book?
Well, he went to an old Chicago bookseller who had set up in New York in the early 30s as an independent publisher. His name was Pat Cavici. And Pat was very impressed with his gifts and offered him an advance to do another book, not this one, which I have to admit was not much good, neither his book nor my introduction, announcing him as great genius, coming genius, and denouncing bourgeois America and so on. We were 16 at the time.
So what did get you to New York? And you lived in New York through part of the 40s through the 60s, is that right?
Well, that's where New York was where the action was. And if you were interested in the literary life, you couldn't stay in Chicago anymore because the great literary days of Chicago were definitely finished by the middle of the Depression years. And anybody who was somebody had already gone off. It was either in Hollywood or New York, and there was nobody left in Chicago. So I went to New York. I hitchhiked to New York a few times to start a literary career. And somehow I did.
Well, let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
My guest is Saul Bellow, and his new book is a novella called The Bella Rosa Connection. We'll be back right after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Saul Bellow is my guest, the winner of 3 National Book Awards, the Pulitzer Prize and the Nobel Prize for Literature. In your book, Humboldt's Gift, you refer to, quote, the fastidious goy critics on guard for the Protestant establishment and the genteel tradition. Now, you were really one of the first of the modern Jewish novelists to really make it and reach a wide audience in America. Did you ever feel when you were starting out that you were up against a non-Jewish establishment who might keep you out?
Well, it always helps a young writer to be a belligerent. militancy is what he chugs along on. So You have to discount us. You have to enter a discount for some of this. It's true that we had the experience of first of being locked out, and then of being admitted partly as under the aspect of curiosity. You know, I mean, as Samuel Johnson said about lady poets. They're like dogs that walk on their hind legs. The miracle, what is interesting is not that they do it badly, but that they can do it at all. And I think that this was the category I felt myself being thrust in, and I didn't really like it very much.
What gave you that feeling?
I was battlesome. Well, you know, we had no sooner arrived and begun publishing books, people like Malamud and I, and later on Roth, Then we were tagged as Jewish writers. Nobody wants to be tagged in that way. I mean, we thought of ourselves as belonging to the mainstream. We were Americans of Jewish origin. That didn't mean that we had to be tagged that way. And I, for one, really didn't like it. And I jokingly named Roth, Malamud, and myself as the Hartshaffner and Marx of American literature. But that stuck rather. I mean, the idea that that you were not a full partner in this enterprise.
Did you ever feel that, looking back, do you ever feel that there were things that you kept out of your voice as a writer, so because you didn't want to be pegged as a Jewish writer? Before you really came?
Oh no, I simply wrote what turned me mm-hmm. on, and mm-hmm. I never gave this much thought at all.
Mm-hmm. You changed your name when you started writing from Solomon Bellows to Saul Bellow, and I was wondering why you changed your name and why you chose the change that you did.
Well, I didn't. I had been known under both names in the family from the beginning, and you know, I had a choice open to me, and I simply decided that. That Saul would be better than Solomon because of the little verse, Solomon Grundy, born on Monday, et cetera, et cetera. And it was besides, I wanted to break with everybody, my own family too. So I chose the other name, which was a legitimate name and belonged to me.
What was your family's reaction when you changed the name?
They couldn't have cared less.
Why not? Because it did represent, I'm sure, to them somewhat of a break from the family.
I didn't deny anything, didn't deny they were my family, didn't turn my back on them, didn't assume some fancy name like Courtney or Smithson or anything like that. There I was. I wasn't trying to hide anything.
Chicago is the setting of much of your fiction, but you lived in New York from the 40s through the 60s. And you say that you returned to Chicago when writers became more political in New York. And I was wondering what kind of political expression you wanted to get away from when you left New York.
Oh well, I just didn't care much for the carrying on about the Vietnam War and so on. I mean, I took my own stand on these matters. I didn't care to be associated with a whole gang of other people.
And did it accomplish what you wanted to move to Chicago, in terms of getting away from a group?
Well, I had belonged to a group in New York. I belonged to the old Partisan Review group.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't impose anything on you, and they didn't try to school you in any attitude. They didn't prescribe for you politically. You could think anything you liked. The new outfit wanted to prescribe for you.
Who were you thinking of in the new outfit?
Oh, the mailers and the people like that, people around him. Oh, well, there were several literary establishments that sprang up about that time. There was a New York Review of Books literary establishment. There was the Mailerite establishment. There was the Columbia University establishment. headed by Lionel Trilling and Jacques Barzin, I suppose. I just didn't want to belong to any of these outfits. I had nothing in common with them particularly.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm curious, you've never written a memoir. So many writers do write a memoir about their lives. And I wonder why you haven't.
I wonder, too. But I'm fascinated by the memoirs of other people, but I don't think I don't think that my own I'm not sure that my own memoirs would be as interesting as, say, the memoirs of Casanova or somebody like that. I did my best, but I don't think I can keep up.
Well, Casanova aside, there is quite a tradition of the literary memoir.
Yes, and some of them are dreadfully dull or self-justifying. And I'm just too busy to do it.
Mm-hmm. In 1970,
when I say I'm busy, I like to qualify that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not just busy in the way a Wall Street broker is busy. I'm busy trying to find out what the next necessary thing to write is, because life is short. You don't want to write anything unnecessary. I don't want to have to devote years of my life to doing something that doesn't interest me most deeply. So I always think of the next necessary thing to do as a writer. And it hasn't occurred to me as yet that my autobiography might be necessary. At the moment, it still looks superfluous.
In 1975, in a piece in Newsweek, you expressed your fear of being elevated to grand old man status, and you said that that's a way of just being eased out. I was wondering if you still are concerned about that, and if you feel you've tried to.
I'm not concerned about it at all. I just don't do it.
Don't do what?
In my time, I've watched writers and poets playing this role, and I just don't care for it.
What's the role specifically that you're talking about?
Oh, the sort of Robert Frost grand old man role. You know. I am now the spokesman of my generation, or I am the spokesman for America. And so I've never considered myself that kind of spokesman.
So are there things that you turn down because you don't want to play that role? Certain speaking invitations or certain things that you are asked to write? Certain stands you are expected to take?
Well, I turn down invitations because I don't want to waste my time. That is to say, if I didn't have anything better to do, I might accept them and go forth and glitter as a public figure. But since I'm too busy, I turn them aside for the most part.
Your last two books have been novellas. Do you think you're going to continue in that vein for a while? Do you have a third one that's going to be published?
No, I don't. Well, I write what my inner voice tells me to write. And it's in charge, not me.
Uh-huh.
I know I should say not I. But I say not me because it's more colloquial.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Saul Bellow's new novella, The Bellarosa Connection, is published by Penguin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be the British writer Margaret Drabble. She made her reputation in the mid-60s as the preeminent novelist of the modern woman. Her books featured intellectual women trying to balance family and career. During the first half of the 80s, Drabble edited the Oxford Companion to English Literature. She has a new novel called A Natural Curiosity. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. His wife calls him the most boring guy in the world, but Jerry Markbright's single-minded pursuit of a career as an NFL referee got him to the Super Bowl twice. He tells us about some of the toughest calls he's made on today's Fresh Air. And poet Gregory Janikian reads something from his collection, Falling Deeply into America. He was born in Alexandria, Egypt, but when he came to America as a young boy, he thought everything here was exotic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Panama City was calm and quiet today after rebel troops failed in their attempt yesterday to overthrow General Noriega. Alan Tomlinson has more on the story.
As the curfew imposed here last night was lifted at dawn, one thing became crystal clear. General Noriega is still firmly in charge of Panama. He made several brief public appearances during the day after outwitting the second coup attempt against him in 18 months. A Noriega spokesman said six of the rebels were killed and 60 captured, some of them with wounds. There are persistent but unconfirmed reports that the coup leader, Major Moises Giralde, is among the dead. The Noriega spokesman said that two other alleged coup leaders took refuge on an American military base. General Noriega's civilian opponents also appeared to have gone into hiding. U.S. troops based here remain in a high state of alert, but the main military presence is that of Panamanian defense forces loyal to General Noriega. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Panama City.
On Capitol Hill, the House bowed to protest from senior citizens and voted to repeal a catastrophic health insurance program approved only 1 year ago. The 360-66 vote to do away with the plan was bipartisan. After that vote, the House then considered a plan that would restore a small part of the program, but that, too, was defeated. The legislation now goes on to the Senate. 18 East Germans, including 8 children, left the U.S. Embassy tonight in East Berlin with promises from the East German government that they will be allowed to leave for West Germany legally. NPR's Mike Schuster in Berlin has more.
The 18 East Germans appeared at the U.S. Embassy earlier today seeking asylum. And as the news spread through East Berlin, up to 50 more East Germans looking to flee to West Germany gathered outside the embassy. Perhaps twice as many East German police tried to clear the street outside the embassy, and scuffles broke out. Some of those trying to enter the embassy cried, "This is our last chance." Earlier, officials at the embassy said they were looking for a humanitarian solution to the presence of the East Germans, and the State Department said diplomatic contacts with both Germanies had been underway. Festivities to mark East Germany's 40th anniversary are planned here for Saturday, but the mass exodus of East Germans has overshadowed those celebrations. I'm Mike Schuster in Berlin.
A federal court judge in San Francisco has dismissed the core of the nation's largest comparable worth lawsuit, in which it was charged that California underpaid thousands of women in state jobs. Federal Judge Marilyn Hall Patel ruled that the California State Employees Association had failed to prove deliberate sex discrimination in state salaries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at another all-time high, rising over 16 points to close at 2,770.89. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. He may not be a football hero, but Jerry Markbright is one of the best-known referees in the NFL. He's written about his 34 years as a football official in his autobiography, Born to Referee. Weekends during the season, millions of TV viewers see him whistle in mouth. Last weekend, Markbright was in New Orleans officiating the Saints-Redskins game. I asked him what he does during the week.
I have a regular job. I have been employed by the 3M company since 1956. I am the trade and barter manager of the advertising services division of 3M Company. Now, don't ask me what that is.
Yeah, I wasn't even going to. This is quite a double life, isn't it?
Well, really, I basically use the same skills in both jobs. I'm a negotiator on my job with 3M, and I am constantly negotiating and trying to be right all the time in the officiating field. Both jobs are tough. Officiating's a little bit more fun and exciting.
Mm-hmm. You say when I announce a call, I'm like a policeman letting you know you're caught.
Well, maybe I over-exaggerated a little bit in the book, but when I make a call, I let the TV audience and the people in the stadium know exactly what's going on. As an example, if a pass interference call has been made against the defense, I step out, I look crisply at the press box, turn my microphone on, and announce with the signal simultaneously, pass interference, number 48, defense, automatic first down. Off goes the microphone, and then I have demonstrated exactly what has happened on the field.
What's the worst challenge you ever got from a coach or a player? A challenge to your call?
Oh, it happens all the time. There isn't a worst one. Every time you make a tough call against a team and, of course, a player, and they feel that it's unjust, they're going to challenge you. And it happens all the time. It happens in every game. There is no worse one. They're all bad.
What happened last week?
Well, we had a situation closing moments of the game when the offensive team false started, simulating the start of the play. The whistle was blown, and a Washington player broke through the line and hit the quarterback. Now, the play hadn't even started. There was no play. It had been negated. And, of course, that's a 15-yard penalty for roughing the quarterback. And the man that roughed him was upset and wanted to know why the penalty flag had been thrown. It was extremely upset, kept following me around until I finally got away from him. And that's the kind of thing that happens. I expect it.
Did you say something to him as he was following you around?
No, I merely tried to explain what I had called, and he didn't want any part of it, so I just stopped talking.
How much of an explanation do you feel like you owe a coach or a player who's challenging you?
Always an explanation if they ask you a legitimate question. It's only fair that you explain. And if they continue on the same course, of course, there's nothing more to say. I say it once, and that's the end of it.
Do you feel threatened by video playbacks?
No, absolutely not. I don't feel threatened by the replays because, to me, replay is a benefit to football. Pro football is the only professional sport that has the guts to have something like instant replay so that an error in ball possession, sideline plays, fumbles, etc., can be corrected if the mistake is made. No other professional sport allows that. I think it's good.
Mm-hmm. How often do you watch playbacks?
We'll look at the game film of the game we officiated a week from that game. We arrive into the city of the next week's game on Saturday, and the film is there waiting. It has been graded by the league office. And then we'll spend 3 or 4 hours on Saturday afternoon reviewing last week's game to see how we officiated. And we can review the entire game in slow motion to see exactly what we did.
Have you ever laid awake at night thinking, I made the wrong call?
Absolutely. I question many things that I do after a game. I'm in thought, deep thought, all week. I had 4 or 5 real tough calls in our game last Sunday. Every time I stop doing what I'm doing, I'm thinking about those calls. I can't wait until I see the film next week to see what happened.
And what if one of those calls, if watching it slowed down, you realize you made the wrong call? What does that mean? What would you do?
Well, first of all, when I get the film, it's already been graded by a supervisory staff in New York.
Right.
And if I made a mistake, then I'm downgraded. You see, officials are rated on all the calls that they make. Every call that you make throughout the whole regular season is given a numerical grade. All of those grades compiled at the end of the season determines your position among the people at your position. I am a referee. There are 16 referees. At the end of the year, my grade computed ranks me from 1 to 16 at my position. The referee that finishes ranked 1 is the Super Bowl referee. The top 9 are the playoff officials, and the bottom 7 don't get anything, so it's very competitive, and every mistake has an effect on your final position, so it's very critical that you be right.
What do you train your eyes on during different kinds of plays? How do you know when you should be watching the ball, when you should be watching individual players?
Well, each official has a specific responsibility on every play, and you must tunnel vision your area and not be distracted by the rest of the action going on. My job as the referee is to watch the snap of the ball, the quarterback, and surrounding blocking and action around that quarterback. That's my primary responsibility. Once he throws the football, it's somebody else's. I don't even watch it. Mm-hmm. And everyone else has that same tunnel vision type of officiating technique. You've just got to concentrate on what you are responsible for. If you start to be a viewer and a fan of the game, you're going to fall on your face.
You were once inadvertently tackled while officiating. Would you tell us about that?
Oh, I've been knocked down and hit and tackled many times, but every once in a while you step in and try to get something done quickly, and somebody thought that I was the ball carrier and tackled me, and of course he weighed 300 pounds, and I went down like a ton of bricks and was very lucky to get up off the ground.
Wasn't your striped shirt something of a giveaway?
Well, you know, when you're down low and you see a set of legs run by, I guess they just knock everything down. It's only happened to me once.
Was this a televised game?
Oh, yes. They're all televised.
So what did you do?
I just got up and muttered a few things under my breath and went on to my next play.
Anyone make fun of you?
Oh, they always make fun. The announcers laugh and the crowd laughs, but when a 300-pound player knocks you down, steps on you, stomps on your foot, accidentally bumps you, it hurts. Especially when you're 5'9", 180 pounds.
Well, forgetting the pain, it must break your concentration.
No, you just have to go right back to it. You forget about the pain and you go right back. Otherwise, you'll make a mistake on the next play.
Jerry Markbright is my guest. He's an NFL referee and the author of an autobiography called Born to Referee. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. NFL referee Jerry Markbright is my guest. The first foul that you called in your role as an NFL official, you didn't get the number of the player?
Well, I was working with the famous Tommy Bell, who was a wonderful man and one of the premier referees of all time in the NFL. Tommy was from Lexington, Kentucky, and he was a stickler for getting the number of the fouler. And as we walked down onto the field for my first regular season game, he had his arm around me. He said, look, he said, in a couple of minutes, you're going to have the first foul of your NFL career. Make sure it's a good foul. And, of course, make sure you get the number of the fouler. I said, Tom, you can count on me. Don't worry. And 2 or 3 minutes into the game, I had a defensive offside. It was a simple call. The two middle players on the defense looked exactly the same. They both had numbers beginning with 6. I couldn't make out whether this fellow was 67 or 68. When the play was over, I raced in to try to determine before Bell saw what was going on. He saw the foul, saw the flag down, killed the clock, looked over at me, said, what do you have? I said, I've got offside defense. He said, and? I said, Tom, it's either 67 or 68. With that, he turned his microphone on. He stepped out, and instead of looking up at the press box like a referee always does, he looked right into my face and announced to the crowd and the TV audience, he's got offside defense, and he didn't get the number.
Pretty embarrassing.
Well, it was the last time I ever reported a foul without giving the number.
But you genuinely, it's not, you know, you genuinely didn't know which it was. So what were you going to do, make up whether it was 67 or 68?
That's the whole point. You can't make a number up. But you're expected to get the number, and I always get the number now. I just guess I wasn't concentrating enough at the time.
So who ended up with the foul?
Oh, they determined later in the game who it was, but it really isn't that important because when they look at the film, they can see who it is. So it really, it's nothing more than a statistical error.
Are you ever in a position where you have to fudge it because you couldn't see exactly?
Well, if you absolutely can't see it, you just don't report a number. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, the referee will step out and give a call, offside defense, instead of giving the number. And that should tell the people that whoever called the foul just absolutely did not get the number of the fouler.
Well, even though you don't have your whistle with you, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about whistle technique.
Whistle technique is something that I've always considered an art, because anybody can blow a whistle, but it's the way you blow it and when you blow it in certain ways that has a great effect on the field. There are certain situations that require a specific type of whistle blowing. It's hard to describe verbally, but it has a great effect on the field. There are soft whistles, hard whistles, staccato whistles, all indicating different situations and different intensity of whistle blowing.
Do you hold the whistle in your mouth during the length of the game?
Yeah, I carry it in my mouth. And a lot of people don't like that. And every once in a while, someone will criticize me and say, gee, you're always carrying your whistle in your mouth. It's just something I've always done. I feel comfortable. Just before the play starts, I put it in my mouth, and it stays there until the play is over.
Well, what's wrong with that? Why would anyone object to that?
I don't know. Maybe it looks funny. Every time there's a picture of me anywhere, it's always with a whistle sticking out of my mouth.
Do your muscles get sore?
Well, at the beginning of the season, the only thing you can't condition is your face, because you can't go out in the park and blow a whistle and get yourself into condition, because if you go out in the park and blow the whistle, the police would come. If you blew it in your neighborhood, someone would think someone was being attacked. So I don't blow the whistle from the last football game until the first one the following year. So my neck and my facial muscles are so sore after that first game that I always forget, gee, my neck is sore. I wonder if I'm getting a cold or a stiff neck. It turns out that it's from blowing the whistle.
Are you one of the few Jewish referees in the NFL?
I'm the only Jewish referee at my position. There are a couple other Jewish fellows that officiate in the league. Howard Slavin is a field judge from California, and Ron Botchin is an umpire from California.
Did you think it was going to be that there'd be any difficulties for you because of that?
No, uh-huh. I've never had any difficulty in any way.
You talk about how there's this kind of ritual among the officials of going to church before a game, and how you weren't really sure if you should go or not.
Well, I had never been in church till I came in the NFL. And, of course, Tommy Bell, who was a Southern Baptist, took me aside in our first game and said, we've got three Catholics on this crew, and the crew is going to church on Sunday morning and has done so for years. And everyone goes, whether they're Catholic or not. Are you going to go? And I said, well, if everybody else is going, I'm going to go too. I was a little apprehensive, but this is 14 years later, and I have been in church every Sunday morning for the last 14 years for every football game. And I feel very comfortable there, and it makes the crew closer together. And every time they mention Israel in the Mass, my crew turns to me and nods as if I had talked to the priest prior to the Mass. I feel good about going, and I think that it's something that has become an integral part of my officiating career. I wouldn't go out and work a football game without being in church first.
Ever take the other guys to a synagogue?
Well, they all want to go, but we can't find one that's open on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock.
When did you decide to be a referee? You'd think most athletes want to grow up and become players. At what point did you want to be a referee?
Well, I wanted to be a player, too. I played all sports. Football was my favorite. I went to college not on a scholarship. I wasn't a great high school player. I played freshman football at Illinois, and then played varsity ball for a while and just got beat up so bad I realized that I wasn't big enough or strong enough to continue. And I realized that my football career was over and that what would I do for the rest of my life? I loved football so much. Someone said, why don't you try officiating football? And I started working intramural games. And when I graduated, I pursued that aspect of football through my old high school coach, who was a football official. Joined a local officials association, and began officiating the B'nai B'rith Touch Football League in 1956. And since then, I've worked every level of football that exists up into and including the National Football League. It's been a wonderful 34 years. It's given me a lot of pleasure.
Has the pay for officials changed a lot in the years that you've been working?
I started working the B'nai B'rith Touch Football League for $3 a game, and I now get $1,500 a game in the National Football League. Playoffs pay $5,000, and the Super Bowl pays $7,500.
When you're a referee, do you get things like health benefits from the NFL, or do you need to get that from the job that you hold down during the week?
We have workman's compensation insurance, and we are covered from the time we leave home until we get back home and all throughout the football season under workman's comp, and we have a retirement plan. It's a very nice arrangement.
Mm-hmm. But for health insurance, you have to go to your job. Right.
Yes.
Okay. When you first started officiating, your crew chief said to you that it's a big game and that you should all be outstanding because you don't want anyone to remember you. You must work so expertly that after the game is over, it will seem as if you weren't there. This whole idea of the referees and the officials being so good that they're invisible. Is that still possible with television, really? Aren't you an example of the referee no longer being invisible?
That's correct. That's a very good observation. The other men on the crew, the other six officials, are really still able to be anonymous, but the referee has become a media figure of sorts, as minor as it might be. Every time there's a call, it's referee Barth or it's referee Tunney or referee Mark Bright making the call. And so your face is known on television. So, yes, it's hard to be anonymous. In the old days, it wasn't.
Where are you headed next weekend, by the way?
I'm going up to Green Bay, Wisconsin. I've got Dallas at Green Bay.
You think it's going to be a hard game for you?
Every game is hard. They're all tough. They all are very important. They mean everything to the teams that are playing, and that's the way I treat them.
Well, good luck at the game, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry Mark Bright's autobiography, Born to Referee, is published by Pocket Books. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. More from Panama?
Yes. No change down there, but we'll be hearing from reporter Alan Tomlinson in Panama and from Ann Garrels in Washington, piecing together just what happened yesterday, what the Panamanian troops did and what the U.S. did or didn't do. We'll also be talking to two men who have different opinions of what the U.S. should have done. One who says that the United States should have assisted that coup, that it's the only way that Noriega will ever be removed from power, and another who says that, no, we should not intervene in Panamanian affairs, and we certainly shouldn't encourage officers to stage a coup and then let them hang out to dry.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. America was an exotic place to Gregory Janikian when he moved here with his family in 1957. He'd spent the first 7 years of life in Alexandria, Egypt. His family moved first to Tarrytown, New York, then to Pennsylvania. We invited Janikian to read a poem from his book, Falling Deeply into America.
In the elementary school choir. I had never seen a cornfield in my life. I had never been to Oklahoma, but I was singing as loud as anyone. Oh, what a beautiful morning. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye. Though I knew something about elephants, I thought, coming from the same continent as they did, and they being more like camels than anything else. And when we sang from Meet Me in St. Louis, clang, clang, clang went the trolley, I remembered the ride from Rumleh Station in the heart of Alexandria all the way to Rushdie where my grandmother lived, the autos on the roadway vying with mule carts and bicycles, the Mediterranean half a mile off on the left, the air smelling sharply of diesel and salt. It was a problem which had dogged me for a few years, this confusion of places, and when in fifth grade geography I had pronounced Des Moines as though it were a village in France, Mr. Kephart led me to the map on the front wall, and so I'd know where I was, pressed my forehead squarely against Iowa. Des Moines, he'd said, rhymes with coins. Now we were singing zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay, and every song we'd sung had in it either sun or bluebirds, fair weather or fancy fringe, oh, beautiful America. And one tier below me, there was Linda Deemer with her amber waves and lovely fruited plains, and she was part of America, too, along with sun and spacious sky, though untouchable, and as distant as purple mountains of majesty. This is my country, we sang, and a few years ago there would have been a scent of figs in the air, mangoes, and someone playing the oud along a clear stream. But now it was my country, 'tis of thee, and I sang it out with all my heart, and now with Linda Deemer in mind. Land where my fathers died, I bellowed, and it was not too hard to imagine a host of my great uncles and grandfathers stunned from their graves in the Turkish interior and finding themselves suddenly on a rock among maize and poultry and squanto shaking their hands. How could anyone not think America was exotic when it had Massachusetts and the long tables of Thanksgiving? And how could it not be home if it were the place where love first struck? We had finished singing. The sun was shining through large windows on the beatified faces of all who had sung well and with feeling. We were ready to file out and march back to our room where Mr. Kephart was waiting. Already Linda Deemer had disappeared into the high society of the hallway. One day I was going to tell her something. Des Moines, I was saying to myself. Baton Rouge. Terre Haute. Boise.
Gregory Janikian teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His collection of poems, Falling Deeply into America, is published by Carnegie Mellon University Press. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. We have research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Margaret Drabble made her reputation writing introspective novels about educated women. On the next Fresh Air, Drabble tells us why she's not writing that kind of novel anymore. Also, Harold Becker describes his work directing Al Pacino and Ellen Barkin in Sea of Love. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.